Steve, thanks. It's Bill Leffin. It's Wendy Snyder on WGN, along with Tom Dreesen and Jamie Masada. Jamie, of course, the founder of the Laugh Factory, chain of great comedy clubs, and Tom Dreesen, one of our city's finest comics ever. And did you hear Wendy?
I know. I'm sorry I yelled at you guys.
Did you hear this? Well, no. Even earlier, you came into our office, Tom, to say hello. Uh-huh. You leave, and Wendy was swooning. It was like Bobby Darin had come into our office.
Oh, my God. I loved Bobby Darin as well.
Wendy's got to get her eyes checked.
No, I said you look great. You have aged like a fine wine, and I want to drink you in.
I like that.
Oh, that's where it starts.
By the way, Wendy, I'm going to use that, Wendy, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
That's a great pickup.
That's how it starts.
Did you like Bobby Darin, seriously?
Oh my God, Beyond the Sea, one of my favorite songs.
He was one of the greatest nightclub stage performers that Chobin's has ever known. The tragedy is he died at 38.
Yeah. So young.
But Sammy Davis, when I toured with Sammy, they mm-hmm. would talk about Bobby Darin. I remember one night Sammy, at the end of a song, he the spot was on him, and he finished the song and he put his fingers up and the spot went out. And I said, whoa, that was real clever. And when he came off, I said, Sammy, that was really creative. He said, Bobby Darin. I stole that from Bobby.
Really?
He said, we used to go watch, but Bobby was such a great live performer.
Yeah.
You know? Never had the honors, but boy, I loved him.
We were thinking about you. We had Frank Sinatra Jr. on, and we were talking about Frank's 100th birthday.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about what that must have been like for you as a kid, idolizing Frank Sinatra, and then all of a sudden, flash forward a couple of years, and you're his opening act.
Yeah. Well, I used to shine shoes in Harvey, and he would be on all the jukeboxes.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes when I'd be flying with him, I toured with him 14 years until the day he died. I was a pallbearer at his funeral, and I spoke at his funeral as well. And there were times I'd be in the private jet with him, and he'd be talking to me, hey, Tommy, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And it'd be so surreal to me. You know, I would want to pinch myself and say, I can't believe I'm sitting here in Frank Sinatra's jet.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember coming out of the service and working construction on him saying, come fly with me. Let's fly away. And now I'm flying away with him. It was
How
so
does
surreal.
That happen? Isn't that amazing the way life can be?
I know. It was so surreal. Even to this day, when I think back of all those years, sometimes it almost like, did it really happen?
Yeah.
And the reason I stayed with Frank Sinatra all those years, he never knew how much in awe of him I was.
Really?
Yeah. I never let him. No, because I picked up on that when I first started touring with him, I picked up on maybe my being a bartender, my instinct, that he didn't want another fan. He had 20 million fans.
Right.
He had 100 million fans. He wanted a pal, a buddy. And so I never, how many times I wanted to say to him after a performance, wow, Frank, that was so great. Or you know, I was watching The Manchurian Candidate the other night, and when I saw From Here to Eternity, but I realized that would have been a turnoff to him.
He didn't want you geeking out over him.
No.
He wanted to just talk
he
to
wanted
someone.
A buddy, a pal. He wanted to talk about the Dodgers and the Cubs, and we'd talk about Harry Carey. I mean, he wanted to talk to another guy. And then as he got older, it was almost like he was my father. He gave me fatherly advice all the time. As he got older, he got a little more melancholy and started talking about his childhood in Hoboken and what it was like. And so, you know, we had... I tell the story real quick. One night he came and got me out of my bungalow. He had a big compound in Rancho Mirage with all these bungalows on the perimeter of the compound. They were named after his songs. Strangers in the Night, Tender Trap, My Way. You know, that's what the bungalows were. And all of his house guests would stay there, like Gregory Peck and his wife and Kirk Douglas and Clint Eastwood and Admiral Shepard and so forth and so on. But one night he came and got me. He says, take a ride, because he never went to bed till the sun came up. So we're riding around in the desert in like 3:30 in the morning. And 4:30 in the morning, we're talking, and all of a sudden, he told me something real personal, real private and personal. And then he said, I wish I wouldn't have told you that. I said, that's okay. He said, I shouldn't have told you. I said, well, it's not going any further than this car. He said, no, I know, but I shouldn't have told you that. I said, well, it's not like we're strangers, you know,
right.
We're friends. And then I looked at him, and I went, Strangers in the Night? He said, oh, my God, if you're going to sing that song, get in key. So he said to me, Strangers in the Night. I said, Exchanging Glances. He said, Wondering in the Night. I said, well, what were the chances? And we did the song, pulled in this compound. He always gave me a sock on the jaw. He said, good night, Tommy. He'd give me a kiss on the cheeks. And he said, good night. I'm going back to my bungalow, and I'm thinking, if I went back to Harvey, and I told all the guys in the bar, I was just riding around with Frank, and we were singing Stranger in the Night, they'd say, get the heck out of here. You think we're going to believe that bull? But it happened, and it's a memory I'll never forget.
What'd you do on his 100th birthday? Did you salute him in your own personal way?
Oh, yeah, and I've got a one-man show I'm doing around the country called An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra. And also some promoters are calling it The Man Who Made Sinatra Laugh. And I do that show all in honor of his 100th birthday. I'm doing it all this year in different places, you know. So, I toasted him, you know. I loved him. I can't describe to you my feelings about him. He was a buddy. He was a pal. He was my boss on the shows. Right. He taught me so much about show business, but also that he was like a father to me, and I miss him every day of my life. I really do.
One of the stories he's told me about Frank Sinatra, that was about his Coughlin. You got to tell him. I mean, I was so touched by it. And then afterward, I'll tell you my encounter with Frank Sinatra. Go ahead, tell him
What's the story, Tom?
I love that story. The Coughlin, he...
Oh, no, Coughlin? We were coming out of the Waldorf Astoria. Frank Sinatra had no value at all for material things. He didn't care about money or any of those things, but we're coming out of the Waldorf Astoria, heading for a gig. We're going out the back door, and security was rushing him to the limo, and a woman started screaming, "Mr. Sinatra, Frank, please, Frank," and security stopped her. The doorman told me she'd been hiding there for 5 hours. Finally, Frank turned around and said, "What is it?" She said, "Please, Mr. Sinatra, please." And he said, "What is it?" She said, "My husband is home sick. Mm-hmm. If you would sign an autograph, it would mean the world to him. It would mean everything." He said, "Sure." And he's signing the autograph, and she said, "Oh, what beautiful cufflinks." They were $2,000 cufflinks. I know where he got them at. He said, "Thank you." And when he finished the autograph, he took the cufflinks off, and he said, "Give these to your husband." She said, no, I don't want them. I'm only admiring them." He said, "No, I want your husband to have them." We get in the limo, and I said, "Frank, that was beautiful, but why did you do that?" He said, "Tommy, if you possess something that you can't give away, then you don't possess it. It possesses you."
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And something I never forgot.
You know? That's really deep.
And the time Jamie? I heard it, of course, Tommy, now he said $2,000. Then he said to me it was $20,000.
Oh, well. No, it was not.
Your mileage may vary.
If I'm going to tell a lie, I think it'd be that big a lie.
All right, let's do this. We need to take a break, but we want to talk about something that's happening at the Laugh Factory. You guys are giving guys and girls who have always wanted to be a stand-up comic, you're giving them a chance to do just that. So let's discuss that. And then something coming up with Johnny Carson that we want to discuss with
you. Yeah, but also veterans, what we're going to talk about. It's for veteran comedians as well as new comedians and wannabes.
All right.
I'm a wannabe.
Can Wendy come? You love Wendy.
Get on the stage.
I want you to come, and I'll tell you about it. We'll tell everybody after we come back from commercial why this is very important for you in your career.
All right. All right. That's coming up next. It's Tom Dreesen and Jamie Masada, along with us, Bill and Wendy on WGN.
She said she want to come in and do stand-up comedy in the club.
So Jamie, Wendy's dream is to be a stand-up comic.
I love that.
That's what she wants to do.
I mean, we had so many, Billy, we have so many comedians there. We do a program called Comedy Camp for underprivileged kids. We've been doing it for 35 years. A lot of these kids, I have a kid right now, she got her own show on NBC. She was homeless.
Yeah.
And she really wanted to do what she wanted. And what we do, people like Tom Dreesen, the comedian like Tom Dreesen, like Bob Saget, like Dave Chappelle, they all come and give them confidence. Confidence is one of the most important things for anybody in any part of your life. You want to do anything you want. You have a confidence, you could do it.
Sure.
And these are people like Tom Dreesen. They come in, they give them motivation speaking. And he's going to do this the same thing this Saturday at the Laugh Factory in Chicago to give the people they can come in, listen to him, and he give them motivation, speaking and all of that stuff. And it's really important for you, Wendy, to come in one time to see it and try to go on the stage. If you don't do it, you always think, you know, what if I did that? What if I did that? And I think you should do it, sweetie. You should do it.
I think, Bill, if you write my material, I'll do it.
All right.
Okay, I help. And Tom Dreesen is going to help, too.
I'm going to ask Tom Dreesen a question. Yeah. Jamie Masada mentions confidence, and that's all well and good. But do you always have confidence when you go out there?
Yeah, but I like more encouragement. And yes, I do now that I'm a veteran. But when I was brand new, the audience was judge and jury. So if I bombed, I thought, oh, my God, they're the judge and jury. So that means I don't belong in this business. As time went by and I realized that I scored some nights and some nights I didn't, then I started realizing that they weren't the judge and jury, that I was the judge and jury, you know. Even with, you know, the secret is, everybody's got a secret for motivation, and the secret is you. You're the secret. And that's what I do in my motivation. I talk on four subjects: perception, visualization, self-talk, and develop a sense of humor. I did this for corporate America all my life, all my show business career. I've read literally hundreds of books on the powers of the mind. Mm-hmm. I had 8 brothers and sisters. We lived in a shack. 5 of us slept in one bed. My parents drank. I grew up very poor, shining shoes in taverns, setting pins in bowling alleys, caddying in the summertime, selling newspapers on the corner, mm-hmm. to help feed my brothers and sisters. And I tell you, that's the greatest thing that ever happened to me, because that's my perception. And that's what I teach. It doesn't matter where you've been. It matters where you're going. And you're not a victim. The biggest problem with our society today, children are being raised to be victims.
Yeah.
You're a victim. See, it's not your fault. You don't have to take personal responsibility, because I have every excuse in the world to be a drunk or to be an alcoholic, or to be a drug addict or to be in prison. But it's bull, because I take personal responsibility. Here's something quick I tell the audience. I say, I can't do this on the air.
Oh.
I probably can't. Maybe I could.
Does it involve swear words?
Well, no, it's
what?
Not at all. But I say,
kidding.
Yeah, absolutely.
My son once said to me, I didn't ask to be here.
Yeah.
And I said, how many of you have thought that when I talk to college students? And a lot of them raised their hand. Did you ever say that to your parents? I didn't ask to be here. I said, I don't want to give you a biology lesson. But when the male and female make love, from the male comes 5 million seeds. Did you know that? 2.5 million died instantly. The other millions die along the way. And soon there's only 100,000 left. Then there's 50. There's 10,000. There's 100 seeds left. There's 5 seeds left. 4, 3, 2, 1, you. Don't ever tell me you didn't ask to be here. BS, you fought to be here. You're a winner. You were born a winner. I said, now applaud yourselves. I'm in a room full of winners.
Yeah.
You all won. Now what are we going to do with it? You're not a victim. You're a victor. And it's all about perception. You have to start thinking that way. You know, the problem with most comedians, first of all, 85% of all stand-up comedians that I've met, this is my 47th year in show business, so I'm speaking from experience. 85% of all comedians I've met are insecure, neurotic, sometimes psychotic, loved, starved, wrecked.
I disagree with that.
Wrecked. Well, wait a minute. And the other 15% are gifted, confident people who say, I know how to write a joke, and I know how to tell one.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think I'm on the latter, but never trust somebody to tell you they're saying. if you're an insecure, neurotic, love-starved wreck, when you're poor and unknown, when you're rich and famous, it doesn't get better, it gets worse.
Sure.
Because you thought rich and famous was going to take away all this angst. And when it's still there, now you got problems. So my motivation speech is to teach them how to get rid of this before, so you can enjoy the journey. Being a stand-up comic is the greatest profession on the planet, bar none, bar none. We bring health. Laughter brings health and healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we change lives through our comedy. It's the greatest profession. Don't tarnish it. And that's what I tell them. Enjoy this journey. You know, the insurance companies went around the world many years ago trying to find out the 8 fears of man.
Yeah.
Or the 10 fifth of man. They did it for 8 years. You know, death was fourth, pain was second, getting up in front of an audience was number one.
Yep.
If you can get up in front of an audience and talk about being a house painter for an hour, you're in less than 1% of the population of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can get up on stage and make people laugh for an hour, you're in less than 1/1000th of 1% of the population of the world.
Yep.
Therefore, you're special. And that's what I teach these young comedians. Don't tarnish this profession. Don't fill your body with chemicals and stuff that destroy this great gift that you've been given. You know, that your job, you've now been given this gift. Now you have to pass it on. You've got to make people laugh, make people healthy. Anyhow.
That's the reason I always tell all of the comedians, they are doctor of the soul. They go on the stage, you know. I mean, they have a gift to be able to make people escape for 20 minutes, 25 minutes,
sure,
an hour from their pressure, the depression, everything.
Well,
that's a very, very, very
special
talent.
Norman Cousins wrote the book Laughtermath, and he wrote another book, The Anatomy of an Illness. He was dying of a terminal illness, a heart condition. Doctors told him he didn't have long to live. He was laying in the hospital thinking of negative input, stress. They told him it came from stress. He said, if stress made me ill, negative input, then positive input would make me well. So he checked out of the hospital. He'd only watch I Love Lucy reruns, Candid Camera, Three Stooges, The Marx Brothers. He lived 27 years after the doctors told him he was going to die. UCLA did research because of him on what happens to the human body when you laugh.
Yeah.
Endorphins are released from the brain into the bloodstream. So your body goes through an actual chemical change. That's why after a hearty laugh, you've laughed so hard, tears are running down your eyes, and you go, oh, in a sense of well-being.
Sure.
Your body's gone through a chemical change. Laughter is psychologically a deterrent, because if you're watching a comedian, you're not thinking of your problems. The brain can't think of two thoughts at the same time. So it's psychologically a deterrent, but now we know it's physiologically therapeutic. So comedians are physicians of the soul. So.
That's why I like to work with Bill every day, because he's so funny. It helps me forget about my problems
at
home.
How about that? Isn't that a nice compliment? And right back to you. What about this? If people want to get involved in this, and they should, the website is laughfactory.com. Can people just show up? Do they need to call in advance if they win into this
on
Saturday?
We'd appreciate it. We've got over 150, I think, right, Curtis?
So far, 150 signups. Yeah.
And another 80, Dobie Maxwell, is bringing another
his classes.
Like 60, his classes. So, yeah, call the Laugh Factory. But you can come on down Belmont and Broadway. It's not only open for comedians. It's open for the public, because this motivation speech is for any endeavor.
It's positivity. We're hearing it right there. And
that's
to be positive is to be happy.
Yep.
Really.
Yeah. So true. I know we only have a minute, Tom, but I want to ask you about this. You're also in town doing something Johnny Carson related. I know what that show meant to you and your career. What are you doing about Johnny Carson's
Tonight,
show?
Tonight we're at the Museum of Radio and Television, and they're going to launch the Johnny Carson show. It's being shown on Antenna TV now in its entirety, starting from 1977. So it'll be January of 77 and January 26th, and then February, then March. So the months match. And we're launching it tonight. Bill Zamy, who wrote a book on Johnny Carson, Jeff Satzing, Johnny Carson's nephew, will be there, and Doc Severinsen.
Wow.
And we're gonna have just a great time talking about Johnny and what it was like. You know, he changed my career.
Sure.
One appearance on The Tonight Show. I did 61 appearances on Tonight Show.
61.
But the first appearance turned my life around. You know?
He loved you. You already know this, but Johnny Carson loved you. I mean, you could just see it in his eyes when you'd come and sit down next to him. He enjoyed and appreciated what you do.
Well, I'm a kid from the Midwest, and so was he.
Yeah.
You know, and we had like Midwestern values, and I'm an ex-Navy man. He was a naval officer.
Yeah,
I was an enlisted man, so I had to salute him. But you know, but I didn't know him then. But yeah, he was a shy guy, and his show, one appearance on The Tonight Show, changed your whole career.
And I've got to tell you a story about Johnny Carson.
Sure.
Johnny Carson, one time he came to the club and he had a couple of extra drink.
Yeah.
And and he was going to get in his car, drive home. And I said, no, Johnny, you cannot get in the car, drive. I'm going to drive you. He said, you're going to drive me? I said, yeah. He got on the driving side and he gave me the key and we drove him to Malibu.
Yeah.
And he got up, he banged the door, he went inside. I'm outside, I have no money, to get back.
But you may have saved his life.
Did you sleep in his bushes?
No. I hitchhiked. At that point, I hitchhiked back to the club. And afterwards, I was on the show with, not on the show, I was with Tony Randall. We went up there and Tony was telling him, he said, well, I invite you to come to Caesar's Palace. He was performing at Caesar's Palace. You're going to be my guest. He gave me a suite, everything
nice.
To stay there. It
what
was very
guy.
Sweet.
What a man.
Yeah, he was a...
Great to see both of you. The Laugh Factory is where everything we've just been telling you about is taking place. It's this Saturday. Go to laughfactory.com. Jamie Masada, of course, the owner and proprietor of the Laugh Factory, and Tom Dreesen, 47 years in show business. 3 more years, Tom. You get a pen. You know that.
Oh,
you
got to
hold on for 3 more years.
Watch.
Yeah, they'll give you something
it's
nice.
It's at 1 p.m. in the afternoon Saturday, so it's 1 p.m. So it's not evening.
And those shows, they are very special, the shows he does, because in Los Angeles, he does it once in a while. He does it. We beg him to do it because he usually wants money, and he get big money for that to do for corporate. I'm
right.
not going to say over $20,000. He comes in, we make a deal, and this people,
sure.
everybody comes in, and people line around the corner to
right.
to get to see him. And in Chicago, we got to do it every 6 months, get it, become people. As soon as they're going to tell everybody it's a great show.
Go see the show at 1 o'clock, Laugh Factory on Saturday, laughfactory.com/club/Chicago has all your information. Thank you, guys.
Thank you
great
very much.
Thank you, Wendy.
Wendy, we're going to see you hopefully Saturday night there, Saturday daytime, and nighttime. We're going to set up something. You're going to go on the stage.
Oh, I don't know.
That would be fun.
Oh,
okay.
You said it. You committed. You
People
said it. Everybody witnessed in
Everybody
here.
Heard it. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
More after this. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.